continuing and hopefully concluding the topic of stalker and deception. And it's taken a while, but the sources are very important to help us appreciate the balance of the issues. I also want to just make two horos, one to kind of segue from yesterday and talk about its relationship to our sugya specifically, and then to mention one nekuda from the parsha, which relates to the makoros you had this morning, which also connects to this whole topic, and then we'll pick up from where we left off. So yesterday we talked about Shalach Manos and the Chassam Sofer's position that it boils down to two possibilities as to what the purpose was. The view of the Trumas HaDeshen, as he understood it, that it's there to help with the Suda. It's kind of a stucco-oriented mitzvah. And the view of the Manos HaLevi, that it's there to create bonds of friendship and to make people feel good that you are giving them gifts. And we also mentioned that there are many, many nafkaminas, and we didn't mention so many of them yesterday, but that the trend that the Chassam Sofer started by connecting it to these two possibilities was picked up by many, many authors over the past 200 years. So just to mention one that is directly relevant to our sugya, just to kind of synergize it back into our daf specifically while we're here, there is a discussion that Achronim have, should we apply kfiya to Shalach Manos? That's what our sugya started off with, the whole notion of kfiya b'staka. So should there be kfiya when it comes to Shalach Manos? This was discussed, among others, by Rav Yaakov Batzal Zsolti. Rav Yaakov Batzal Zsolti was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim until, I believe, the early 1980s. And he's most well-known now for a sefer that's very popular called the Mishnas Yavetz. He has a nice shiurim on a lot of areas of halacha. And I've got a popular volume on Moed in which he discusses this question, among others, does it make sense to institute a communal policy of compulsion, of coercion, when it comes to Shalach Manos, in the spirit of what we were learning about here, what we do find kfiya employed for. So how would you relate to that issue? What would you think? How would you understand that? If one's following the Mini Klal Yisrael to associate everything with that Shuvah Chassam Sofer, so would that put you in one direction or the other? Zach?
Well, maybe if it's to make sure everyone has Suda, so then why wouldn't that just be Matanos Levyonim?
Well, so that we discussed a little bit yesterday, that it does mean that perspective that it's about the Suda does align it with Matanos Levyonim. It does make them both of a similar goal of helping people in need, but there is a still different focus between them. Matanos Levyonim being more overt, clear staka that is designated for Levyonim, as the name indicates, while the Shalach Manos still is there to help those in need, but in a far more subtle way to those who are much less obviously in need and may not want to be perceived as people in need. So they would share the ultimate goal, but be very different in their form, very much by design. So if we accept that model, so how would that affect this issue? Yes, sir?
I mean, my gut instinct would be to say that if it's about making sure that people have what they need for the Suda, then kfiya would be applicable. But
okay,
if it's about friendship, it wouldn't. On the other hand, though, if you have someone like do kind acts, they might become friends. So I'm not sure if that's...
Did you say the last part?
If you make the person do an act of friendship that might achieve the goal and just by doing the act.
So that's an interesting question of itself. I think your gut in the first point is probably more relatable. So the way that he assumes, and I think it's an understandable alignment, is that if you assume that it's really a stucco-oriented kind of thing, so then presumably it should line up with the rest of what we learn here, that it should be subject to kfiya, and one could make a case, even though, again, it's not something that we see in our communal structures today, but maybe it theoretically has a place. And maybe we should say that, yeah, we have a Shalach Manos pool in the town, and we want to make sure that everyone is giving enough, that there is enough for those who might be in need to be receiving. So yes, we will check up on your Shalach Manas giving to make sure it maintains a certain minimum. That might be conceivable. But if it's there to create friendship, so then it's harder to see how that really could happen if you show up at your friend's house and you're there with two U.S. Marshals who are clearly pulling you in chains to make sure that you give this, and you kind of grumble as you drop it off. It's probably not going to necessarily be so influential as far as so impactful as far as making friends. Now, here, another point of synergy. This relates to another issue that we'll hopefully talk about today, so let's mention it now, that there is a discussion as to why is there no bracha on Shalach Manos? Why did Chazal not ordain a bracha on that? And in general, the question, if you want to know why there's no bracha on any mitzvah, any specific mitzvah, so there are a couple of key makoros. There's a Beis Yosef in Hilchos Chametz, and there's a tshuva of the Divrei Malkiel among the Achronim, but one of the most go-to sources is a tshuva of the Rashba. The Rashba in Siman Yud Ches discusses our sugi here. Why is it that there is no bracha associated with the mitzvah of tzedakah? So on the surface, what he seems to be saying is that you can't have a bracha that is contingent on somebody else's participation, and a mitzvah that's contingent on somebody else's participation, because maybe they'll leave you hanging. So if you're going to recite a bracha on giving tzedakah, so what happens if the ani doesn't take the tzedakah? So then you'll be left with a bracha that is apparently unwarranted. And that's itself a whole discussion, a lot to say about that. So that's, if that's what the Rashba is really getting at, it's also what to talk about. But in any event, so the Rashba is brought into this discussion because we mentioned yesterday the position of the Rama, that the Rama maintains that if you offer Shalach Manas to somebody and he says, okay, I don't need it, you're still Yotze. So some raised the question that it sounds like all the more so then you should make a bracha on Shalach Manas, because according to the Rashba, you're not going to make a bracha if it's contingent on somebody else cooperating. But here you see from the Rama that even if the other person doesn't cooperate, you'll still be Yotze. Now, there's room to make a distinction. It could be that if he throws it back in your face and says, I hate you no matter what you do, then maybe you're not necessarily Yotze. But maybe it's only specifically if he says, oh, that's such a nice offer, it's the thought that counts, I don't need it. But that's itself a question. But in any event, so this is brought up to strengthen the position that maybe there should be a bracha on Shalach Manas based on that Rashba. So there are some who suggest, I believe among them the Das Sofer, who is certainly entitled to being among the many who followed the Chassam Sofer's approach, as he was a descendant, so at least he's following Minhag Avos. So the Das Sofer suggests that, to kind of go to Zach's point before, that maybe we want to blur the distinction between Shalach Manas and Matanas Levyonim, or blur the similarity between Matanas Levyonim and Shalach Manas. And therefore, we don't want to have a bracha, which by necessity is going to have to identify what mitzvah we're talking about. That's usually the nusach of the bracha. But there are also those who suggest, Sridi Eish has a truth about this, others suggest that in the spirit of what we just said about kfiya, that it's going to seem very strange if you want to give a gift to your friend and have that be perceived as a nice, warm outreach. And when you come to the house, I've got something for you, hold on 1 second, let me first say, blessed is God who ordered me and forced me and commanded me to give you this gift. It's going to maybe kill the mood a little bit. So better if you give it without a bracha, that would be more effective as far as this particular goal of making friends. That's how some suggest. So that's just to kind of synergize yesterday's discussion about Shalach Manas into our daf and in our sugya. Question?
Yeah, Why does the Dasa Peris say it's good to blur the distinction?
Because if we assume that they're kind of hybrid mitzvahs, they're kind of connected together, then that's one way of seeing it. You don't have to necessarily see it that way, but he's assuming that really they're basically kind of overlapping mitzvahs, and that the idea is that we shouldn't necessarily be calling attention to it one way or another, so then to recite the bracha is going to bring that into relief, which we don't want to do. That's one way to understand it. Shmuel?
For the answer that says that, like, we don't want to say the bracha because it's going to counteract, like, the goal of, like, the bond between people.
Mm-hmm.
Is the problem just because we're, like, saying the truth explicitly, or does it reflect a greater approach to, like, how we should approach like, mitzvah ben adam l'chaveiro?
That's actually a very good question. It deserves a lot of attention. I don't want to give it the attention it deserves right now because it'll take us far afield, but I don't want to minimize the question either because it comes up, for example, extensively in the discussion of Kibud Av Ve'Em. You know, how much of it should come from a mitzvah-specific perspective and how much should come from a natural instinct perspective, and does one contradict the other? And there's a lot of interesting background on that. Maybe we should leave it for a future discussion. I don't want to dismiss it because it's a very important question, I think, and there's a lot to consider about it. It will take us farther afield than I think we have time for it today. So keep it in the bank for a future discussion because it is something that brings up a lot of important points. Your own?
Yeah, I was going to piggyback off of Sam a little bit. So then why can't you say that for any bracha you ever make? It's saying it's ruining the mood because you're only doing it because God commanded.
Well, because if the mitzvah has been adam l'makom purely, you know, then there's nothing to worry about. But if the mitzvah has been adam l'chaveiro, so sometimes that will make sense. And it may actually be part of it because there are some who say that that's really what the Rashba is getting at. And that's also consistent with how the Rambam understands it also in Hilchos Brachos, that in general we don't have brachos for mitzvot ben adam l'chaveiro, and maybe taka, that's a part of it.
Right. And then also, according to the Das Sofer, why can't you just include both matanos avyonim and mishloach manos into the bracha so that you don't exclude?
So then that may itself already create a pairing that may be embarrassing to the recipient. You know, oh yeah, I'm a part of your stucker project and not, you know, the avyon. Something along those lines.
Right.
So that's to synergize with yesterday's topic in our daf. And now to synergize a little bit with the parsha, and it's from Rishon of the parsha, and so we could talk about it now before Thursday. But to synergize with that and our sugya right now, that we're in the middle of. So I asked you to look at a Rashi this morning in the parsha to get you started on your Shnei Mikra. But there's something that's worth pointing out, that we know in general that we have an aversion to mitzvos habav yaveira, and any mitzvah that comes through a tainted path is already problematic on a lot of levels. But it's also striking that this week's parsha Vayikra, which brings us into the world of korbanos, so we know that when it comes to korbanos also, first of all, one interesting thing is also there's a role of kfiya by korbanos too, but that's just to mention that while we're on this topic. But also that there is a exclusion of gezel when it comes to korbanos. And that has its own drush. It's separate from the concept of mitzvah habavi avera or other such things. And you could argue it's even the first halacha, if you take the Torah Shebaal Peh together with Torah Shebichsav, it's kemat the first halacha that you learn about korbanos, because in this week's parsha, in the second pasuk of this week's parsha, which starts introducing us to korbanos, so Adam ki yakriv mikem korban. So Chazal interpret Rashi quotes that what do you see from Adam? It's a reference to Adam Harishon. Adam Harishon didn't have anyone else to share ownership with or to compete with ownership, so there was no possibility of gezel in his korbanos. So too, we can't bring korbanos from gezel. And I think there's a point there that's being emphasized that goes above and beyond the general mitzvah habavi avera svara. That it's not just that this is a mitzvah that would be happening through inappropriate ends, and we need to be told that that's not the way to do things, but there's a more fundamental issue here that really kind of calls into question your whole relationship with the specific mitzvah. And when it comes to korbanos, so we're supposed to understand that we're bringing a sacrifice to God. And what's happening there? Are we doing this because we think God needs this? God needs the dead animal for his own purposes? He's hungry, and that's what's going on? Or do we understand that the mitzvah is for us, and it's a korban of our sacrifice? So when one would consider stealing an animal to bring it as a korban, stealing a korban in some form, it betrays not just a person's willing to do an aveira for the mitzvah, but it betrays a complete misunderstanding of what's going on. Because the only way it could possibly make sense to do this, to steal a korban and bring it to God, is if you think somehow, well, God needs my korbanos, so he'll probably be happy that I got him one, even if I had to steal it. But if we understand that God doesn't need your korbanos for his own personal needs, it's about what it says about us, then it makes no sense whatsoever to steal a korban and then bring it. The only possible svara to steal a korban and give it to God would be if you somehow think that God actually needs, in a real way, this korban for himself, and therefore he'll maybe even appreciate even if you got it under illegitimate means. So, in addition to whatever other disqualifications there are for aveiros that are mixed in with mitzvos, here the notion of a korban that would come from gezel is additionally problematic because it displays that you're missing the whole point about what korbanos are, and maybe that also brings up bigger problems as far as your whole religious perspective. So one could argue that that's relevant also when it comes to tzedakah. So why is it that we are told to give tzedakah? So is it that God really needs somehow to get this money to the poor person, and he doesn't have to, he doesn't have any way to do it himself, that somehow he's limited, and therefore he's asking us to perform a mission on his behalf? Or do we assume, no, that God can design the world any way that he wants to, but he specifically gave us the opportunity to give of ourselves to help others? And we talked about in our introduction to tzedakah about the elements specifically, it's about developing your midah of generosity. But even to the extent that you are accomplishing a practical end, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu specifically set up the world to give us the opportunity to be the ones fulfilling this, even though obviously he could have made it unnecessary in the first place. So if someone's going to steal for tzedakah, essentially it's similar to stealing for a korban. You're basically saying that, oh, God needs help, that he needs somehow to get this money to the poor person. He's unable to do it himself, so therefore he gave us the job, and he'll be happy if we get it done, whatever corrupt ways we need to in order to make it happen. So that, in addition to a general mitzvah haba be'aveira kind of problem, goes to a fundamental philosophy of the world. And that's something that is itself highly problematic above and beyond any kind of a mitzvah haba be'aveira idea. And I think that's also relevant to our understanding what the balances are in our sugya in a way that connects in an important fashion to the themes of our parsha. Okay, so with that in mind, so we had talked about the idea that outright fraud, no way, outright stealing, no way, and even Gnevas Das is problematic. We mentioned the apparent contradiction between the Gemara in Erechin, where it sounds like you can create a misimpression about how much money is in the kupa in order to encourage further donations, and the impression of the Gemara in Maseches Sukkah together with the Maharsha, that there is a problem with announcing donations that are more than they actually are, because that's deceptive, and that's what the Gemara means when it says poskei tzedakah v'rabim are going to cause great problems for Klal Yisrael, talking about the people who make these announcements, even though they think it's justified to spur greater donations to tzedakah. So just to continue a little bit of our kind of historical analytical perspective on this, so we mentioned the other day, last week, that the Menachas Yitzchak is the one most well known for his tshuva quoting this Maharsha and understanding that to be the intent of the Gemara specifically, and therefore saying that even in the times of Chazal this was going on, and it was harshly denounced, and that it is included with these other great averos. And we raised the question that it could be that the Gemara could be identifying any of three problems with that, so we don't necessarily know all of that, at least not without the Maharsha. That there's a problem with the neder, there's the problem of showing off to the public that you're such a donor when you're not doing anything of the kind. And there's the problem we're focusing on now, which isn't necessarily the most obvious at all of the three, that you are creating the image of popularity to this tzedaka, which is under false pretenses. So I just want to add to that mix that there is a tshuva written by the Dvar Yehoshua. The Dvar Yehoshua was a dayan in Tel Aviv. His name was Rabbi Yehoshua Menachem Ehrenberg. And he basically was a little bit older than Michal Yitzchak. He passed away earlier, for sure. And he has a tshuva, which I wonder if it was written to the same person. It was written in the Minchas Yitzchak. It doesn't say who it's written to, and we went through it in the skills session, and we noted it's a chaval, because the Minchas Yitzchak indicates that the correspondent had himself included a couple of arguments in this topic, and it would be good to be able to analyze them. So in the tshuva, in the Dvar Yehoshua, I think it's probably to the same person. He identifies who he's writing to, and I know that that particular correspondent is one who, in other tshuvas you can find, he writes a lot of the same question to multiple poskim sometimes and some other issues, so it's very likely that maybe he sent this question to a few of his contemporary poskim. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was the same correspondent writing to the Michas Yitzchak and writing to the Dvar Yehoshua. And the Dvar Yehoshua reflects a little bit more about what the correspondent wrote to him, so to round out the picture for the history books, you can read this tshuva. But he also essentially takes the same position as the Minchas Yitzchak and assumes that, yes, that that's pshat in the Gemara, like the Marasha, that the main issue is that they are spurring on these false donations based on this claim. And he writes there that he thinks that that's the compelling interpretation, because if the issue is just the commitment that they're not following through, so why the emphasis on rabbim? Why say poskei tzedaka b'rabbim? Just say poskei tzedaka that don't follow through. So what's the emphasis on the fact they do it in public? So perhaps that is to say that it's also with the intent of fooling other people into thinking, or gently fooling other people into thinking, that the cause is more popular than it actually is. I wonder still if there's still room to question, because it could still be that it's because they want to show off. That's the point. So the victim here is maybe all the onlookers who see this guy is more generous than he is. So that's the emphasis in the rabbim. So I think there's still room to talk about it, but still just it's interesting to add this tshuva also to the list. And most of his tshuva is longer, but much more of it is focused on the neder component. And to what extent is there a potential neder here, or is that something that's mitigated by the fact that it's done in conspiracy with the Gabbai Tzedakah, who want him to make this announcement in order to get other people to give more? And how much is that a factor? So that's also the topic of a lot of his discussion, but just to bring that into the discussion as well. So we had assumed that what we wanted to assert here is that basically the distinction is to misrepresent the popularity of the cause. That's a problem, like this Marsha and like those poskim who emphasize it. And the Gemara that says that Rav Yanai could allow people to think that the tzedakah box was low, and the Beis Yosef, who even thought, maybe even concluded, that strictly speaking could have even said that out loud and it would have been okay. So the distinction that we favored, among other suggestions, was that it's a big difference between the two types of deception. That create the impression a cause is very popular and encourage other people to give because of that. So that's really deceptive. It's not gazel mamon, because they're still, at the end of the day, they're giving to a cause, they know what it is. But it is potentially still gnevus das. Here, there's no real misrepresentation. If you're just saying the aniyim need money, the aniyim do need money. It's just that people could tell themselves it's not so urgent because they see they've got a full tzedakah box. So when they don't see the tzedakah box is full, so then they feel a greater urgency to give the tzedakah that's needed anyway. So there's no real misrepresentation here. And especially if you're not saying anything out loud. So there's no sheker being expressed, and there's no result, really. There's no means of misrepresentation, there's no ends of misrepresentation at all. Is to just support the idea that people should be giving, which they should be. So it doesn't create any actual falseness. So personally, that was the position that I favored. I think that that allows for a neat reconciliation of all the sources and a straightforward approach to how these things should be carried out. So far, so good. Everybody with me? But there are a few additional sources which need to be considered, and many of them are in the Talmud Yerushalmi, and you saw them already last week. So how exactly do they fit in? So there are some sources in the Yerushalmi that seem to suggest that there is room for still a little bit of blurring of the facts in the process of collecting. Can anyone help me out here? So what do you see in the Yerushalmi that seems to raise that possibility? I don't recall, I guess everybody still from last week. One is a story in the Yerushalmi of two versions of a story, a similar story, of somebody who would collect, and it turns out that really he was actually not collecting for himself, and he ended up distributing that money. He gave the impression he was collecting for himself. He gave the impression that he was a needy person who required that much of donation, but he was actually distributing that money to other aniyim. And it sounds like from that Yerushalmi that that's acceptable. So what can you derive from that? Does that contradict anything we've seen before, seen so far? Is it consistent in what we've seen so far? Does it expand the parameters in any way? What's your impression about that? Well, it sounds a little bit like there is some degree here of misrepresentation. And he is presenting himself as the one who is the beneficiary of all of this tzedakah. And yet, it's not really true. It's really for other people. So is there anything wrong with that? Anything potentially wrong with that? Is that completely fine? What's your perception? Or anything that we should qualify within that, applying that, your own?
I'd say maybe, I don't know how much misrepresentation there is here, because the person probably giving tzedakah or giving it out to this person who they think is poor is ultimately still giving it to people who are poor. Meaning, okay. So the intention of the person giving it was that it gets to a poor person. So whether this guy's actually poor or not, at the end of the day, he's still giving it to poor people, which was the intention of the giver. So I guess the giver wasn't really misrepresented, meaning he may have given it to this person who he thought was needy, even though he's not, it's still going to needy people. So if it was dafka that he wanted to give it to this person because he was needy, maybe there is a shiloh. But if it's just that it goes to needy people in general, maybe it wouldn't have such a big impact.
Okay, so let's explore that for a second, what it means and what it doesn't mean. So first of all, it's interesting. I thought for a second a little bit of a steer until I read it more carefully. That Rav Zilberstein, in his Chashukei Chemed in Ksubis, so he quotes his brother-in-law, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, as referencing the Yerushalmi and saying, don't take this as a proof. But he was talking about the Shiloh we were just talking about, the issue of a cause saying, oh, it's popular, and oh, it sounds like from that Yerushalmi, like it's okay to misrepresent a little bit for the purposes of tzedakah, so you might think it's all right. So there he quoted Chaim Kanievsky as saying, don't think it's okay. That's talking about a guy who really is addressing a real need. He's just kind of covering up how it's getting there. But to say that you can misrepresent in a way that does create a false impression, whether about popularity or degree of need, so that there's no proof from here you can do that. That's how he quotes Chaim in the Chashukei Chemed. In the Sefer Derech Emunah, which is a sefer that was written by Rav Chaim Kanievsky directly, and it's his commentary on the Rambam in Sefer Zeraim, so that includes Hilchos Matnas Aniyim. So the Derech Emunah, Rav Chaim writes that this Gemara is a proof, though, for the case that it describes, that for somebody to pretend that he's the recipient and to actually be distributing it to others, so that is, strictly speaking, okay, as long as you stay within those parameters. Meaning, first of all, he emphasizes that you should make sure that it doesn't create some kind of a chil Hashem if you get caught. If the impression is that it looks like there's a misrepresentation here and people aren't going to pay attention to what it is that's being misrepresented, and they're going to think, okay, the collection is just a phony. So that's going to be a problem. So that's, as a matter of advice, he writes there, that's something to be aware of. And I will confess, I was once part of this whole question, or I was confronted this way. When I was learning in Eretz Yisrael, there was a man, I don't know if he's still around, or if he's still alive, or if he's still active, or if this will be a familiar name, but there was somebody who was known as Super Schnorrer. So I guess that, you know, you're hearing that for the first time. So when I was, so I used to be a little skeptical of Super Schnorrer, because especially somebody who's known as Super Schnorrer sounds like there's something a little fishy. And then I was told that apparently he actually represents a lot of aniyim who aren't able to go out and collect themselves, and he spends all day collecting and then distributing it to all these aniyim. And when I heard that, I ended up having a lot more respect for Super Schnorrer and made sure to always catch him. And I'll also add, again, I don't know if he's still alive or active or not, but Zachar Elso Ish Lato for everything that he did for other aniyim. He also had a special milatim that also was endearing, is that if you walked around Mea Sharim, and you would run into him, but he had a great memory. So at least for that day, he'd always remember who already gave him this. If you saw him in the morning and you gave him, and then later in the afternoon you were there with some friends, so he'll ask the friends, and I'll say, okay, you gave me ready, and he remembered all day who out of all the people he would run into. So he was somebody who clearly had a very serious mahalach towards his collecting. And maybe he was doing what, because he never, I don't remember him ever saying collecting for other people. I guess it somehow just found out that he was distributing to other aniyim, but he presented himself as somebody stam collecting. So it could be that that was the direct reflection of what this Yerushalmi was describing, maybe exactly like that, of somebody who made it out that basically he's collecting for himself, but his real intent was to collect for other people. And if he does that, if that's the extent of it, so then that should be okay. But also the fact that I was suspicious of him initially, so I think that reflects the concern that Reb Chaim mentions in Derech Emunah, that strictly speaking it's mutter, but you also have to make sure that it's not done in a way that turns people off, that creates the impression that there's some kind of phoniness here that's going to distract, it's going to discourage the donation to Tzedakah. Yeah.
So you have the story in the Shami where they thought he was taking Tzedakah when he didn't need it. So
right, so it's interesting, the story
wasn't seem
problematic. Yeah, so that's itself interesting, that there's a couple different ways to get us out of the Yerushalmi, but one of the stories specifically does emphasize, like you're saying, that he developed a reputation for taking too much until it was discovered that he was actually giving it out to others. So what to do with that detail is a good question. It's interesting that the Gemara does make that part of the story, at least for part of it, and what to do with that is an interesting question. But there's also a discussion in the later Svarim that emphasized we have to be very careful to know what exactly is the message of the Yerushalmi. That basically, why were these people not collecting themselves? So if the issue is just that they were embarrassed, they didn't want to be known as aniyim, or maybe they, it's also possible they weren't physically capable of collecting themselves, but let's assume also that they were not willing to expose themselves to people who needed. They were embarrassed. So that's probably the cleanest kind of situation. That the people who gave to, we'll call him Super Schnorrer, people who gave to Super Schnorrer were happy to give tzedakah to whoever's in need. And the people who they were actually giving to, they would have been happy to give them also, but those people didn't want to present themselves as recipients. So, fine. So everybody's happy. Everybody gets what they need, and there's no significant deception there. There's no material deception there that makes any difference to anybody. All there is protecting the kavod of these recipients. So that's 100% glad. What happens if, for some reason, there's something about this person who's collecting that the donors would give him, but they wouldn't have given the other people? So that complicates matters. It's hard to know exactly what that would be, but let's say if a person is a Talmud Chacham of stature, so people feel, okay, I want to support that Talmud Chacham, but if I knew that it wasn't really for him, he was really giving it to other people who I don't have the same respect for, so that gets a little bit more complex, and there's a discussion there about whether that kind of situation can also be gleaned from that Yerushalmi. So that's also an important discussion, and again, I know I'm saying this over and over again, but I feel it's very valuable as a musar exercise, just to see the seriousness and the attention that is given to every one of the makaros here, as far as trying to figure out exactly what it's saying and what it isn't saying, and measuring that against what we know so far in terms of how far you can go with it. So it seems like if there's a reason to say, now Supershnar again was a kind of a personality, and that I think point about his memory, that there was something that was endearing about him. Okay, so fine, he'll be more successful in collecting more than presumably any one of his beneficiaries would have been. That's fine. But if there was some vort, that there's some reason that a person specifically would only want to support him and would not have given if they knew that it wasn't really going to him, it was going to others, so that might complicate things. You have to figure out exactly whether that's still legitimate. There's the Sefer Hasidim, which I put on the list last week, which does sound like that, right? That Sefer Hasidim also tells a story about somebody where it sounds like specifically it's because of his own stature that he was able to get donations, and then he was really distributing it to others. And that theoretically could pose a problem if we had reason to believe that it's really that specific, that the donors really are only giving because of their respect for this particular collector and thinking that he's keeping it for himself, and which is kind of ironic because it's the exact opposite of the normal situation that we're talking about. Normally, in the average situation, a person is collecting, a gabbai tzedakah is collecting, and the whole point is that we hope he's not keeping it for himself and that he is giving it to others. So here's the inversion of that case. What if a person is giving it to others? And that's problematic because the whole donation is motivated by the assumption he's keeping it for himself. So that's where it gets a little interesting, but it's probably unlikely. Those kind of situations are probably few and far between, and especially because the Talmud Chacham, one could assume, also is chayiv in staka and is giving staka. So if I'm supporting this Talmud Chacham and he is using some of that support to perform his own obligation in staka, the percentage of people that are going to have a real problem with that is probably slim. You know, maybe it might depend on if we're talking about a very large kind of donation, where let's say a Talmud Chacham would come to you and say, I need a lot of money, and you get the impression that it's hard for you, it's a lot of money, but because of your great respect for him, you want to help him out, and he's really just giving it to others. You know, maybe in that kind of a situation, there might be some significant deception, but probably in most cases, that's not what we're talking about. Hi.
I'm not sure if this necessarily overlaps, but it overlaps in giving money towards something, and it doesn't necessarily go to the specific case, but it goes to similar ones, organizations that support that raise money for like children's operations and stuff. If they raise more money than they otherwise needed, it'll go towards other kids.
That's something that's actually our next sugya. So hopefully we'll be talking about that tomorrow. But that happens all the time, you know, because it's a very common kind of situation. So there are guidelines for that. That doesn't involve any a priori dishonesty. It just involves a situation of how to address it afterwards. So that's a very practical case. Well, we're going to segue right into that afterwards. So l'chachila, you're not asking that way. L'chachila, you're just trying to address this cause. But the question is what happens after the fact, which is a very common scenario. We'll talk about that. But so that Yerushalmi and that Sefer Hasidim, that also poses a issue to think about. And in the spirit of everything we've seen so far, the great precision and attention to the mechanics of every mucker here to try to understand exactly how far it's taking us and how far it isn't taking us. Now, there is also a concern in the other direction, which the Shulchan Aruch discusses. It was in the Makaros that I sent out today, but it's based on a Yerushalmi in Peya, which maybe you saw last week, where the Yerushalmi tells a story, but there are many other cases you can imagine like this, where somebody wanted to basically misrepresent to the recipient, not to the donor, but to the recipient who otherwise wouldn't have been so ready to accept tzedakah. So the Yerushalmi tells a story about somebody who tells a needy person, oh, guess what? I heard that you just came into a big inheritance and you got money coming to you, so take this for now. And it turns out that he's not really have awaiting a big inheritance, and you're just giving this to him, but that's what you had to say to him in order to get him to take it in the first place. So that kind of gnevis das, so to speak, to get the person to receive. So that's something which on the surface should be okay, right? That is not really victimizing anybody other than the recipient, and the recipient, it's in his interest. So that is in the broader category of justified types of deceptions. And that comes up in a lot of different contexts. So Shulchan Aruch records that din, that you can tell an ani that something he's receiving is not from Staka, even if it actually is. We also have, for example, as we referenced in other contexts recently, that actually lending money is considered to be a big chesed, and in some cases even bigger than Staka, because the person is able to feel more dignified in the assumption that he's not taking it as a gift, but he'll be paying it back. So certainly, and this is a discussion of Mar Hazim Suvas, that if you are going to present something as a loan, that you don't really have any expectation of taking it back, but you have to say it as a loan in order to get the person to take it in the first place, and your full intent is that he's going to keep it forever. So certainly that is permitted from any kind of an honesty perspective, and probably also praiseworthy, because you are allowing him to maintain his dignity in a greater fashion while benefiting him to the maximum degree possible. So what about a situation, let's say I'm a gabbai tzedakah, and I come up to a Talmud Chacham, and I want to give him money from the tzedakah fund that I am in charge of. But I know if I were to say to him that I am in charge of this fund that people are giving for needy individuals, and I'd like to disperse some of it to you, that he's not going to take it. He doesn't want to be seen as a needy individual. He doesn't want to take tzedakah. So I'm not going to be able to tell him that. So instead, I say to him, listen, you're a big Talmud Chacham. You write beautiful svarim. I love your svarim. I want to support your work. So I'm giving you a gift. Is that permissible? What would you say? Any thoughts, any questions about that? No feelings one way or another? No votes one way or another. So, on the surface, it sounds similar to what we just described, right? And indeed, in the Shuvis Shevet HaKohasi, it was written by one of the Dayanim and Bells, of Shammai Kohas Gross, he has a tshuva where he permits that. But we have to emphasize there's room to question it a bit, because it's not the exact same as the case we just discussed. And there is a potential other serious issue. Max?
In the first case, you're giving him a loan and just like not collecting it. In this one, you're just lying to him about what it is that you're giving him.
Yes, but why is that significant here?
And that you're going against his wishes more directly than that.
Okay, it's true. That's significant perhaps also. That is a factor, but I'm thinking of something maybe more significant. You know?
You're deceiving him more in this case by saying, like, I'm doing it to support your Torah or whatever it may be, when that's not actually true.
So I think it's similar to what Max is saying and kind of focusing on the purpose. But that's probably not so harmful. Right? The idea that you're letting him think it's for this reason instead of that reason is not the biggest problem here. There's something else that we're missing. What else might be a more significant issue? So it's an issue that having a little background to the discussion helps, but it's something you could also maybe perceive without the background, that the problem of gnevis das in general is that you get goodwill, you get a reputation, you get social capital, however you want to phrase it, without actually earning it. So that's potentially happening here. Right, that if I told him the truth, so he wouldn't want to take it, but at least he would know that I am the guardian over money that was donated by others, and I am dispersing to him money that other people gave. In this scenario, I'm giving him the impression that it came out of my pocket. So there's going to be a very different level of gratitude. Right? He's going to think that I personally gave him this donation. Right? Maybe I'll get a dedication page in his next sefer because of my generosity. And it wasn't really me. I just made the decision to give him money that other people donated. So that's potentially a significant Gnevus Das. You hear the issue? That I'm taking credit for my generosity here. And it's not my generosity. Yes, he can be grateful that I chose him instead of somebody else to give other people's money to. It's not nothing. But degree makes a big difference, especially in Gnevus Das. And creating the impression that I'm the donor when I'm not the donor, that in other areas would be a significant Gnevus Das. So it's not so obvious this is okay, and in some of these discussions, in some of the Svarim talking specifically about the Yerushalmis we mentioned, they emphasize that one has to be careful in whatever scenario they're employing to avoid, like we said before, creating a Chil Hashem or a discouragement from Staka, and also from creating a Gnevus Das, to give credit where credit is not due, to take credit where credit is not due, does present a halachic problem. Now, the Shevet HaKohasi is mentioned about it. And just to discuss for a second this thought process and to note where it might be controversial, so he wrote that Gnevus Das is an aspect of Sheker, and that Sheker, the Gemara says in Yevamos, Daf Yomi starting Yevamos this week, that Sheker, there is a heter, theoretically, of Mishanim Bnei HaShalom, that you're allowed to deceive people in order to keep the peace. And here, this is included in Shalom, that you are allowing him to be supported in a B'chavidic fashion. So the last part of that sentence, that this is a part of Shalom, I don't think that's so controversial. I think that much we can accept, that the Bnei HaShalom part is active here. The problem is this included in that heter? So he's just clearly assuming that it is, but there is some room to debate it. For example, Rabbeinu Yonah in Shai Tshuva. So Rabbeinu Yonah details 9 different categories of sheker. So sheker breaks down into many different forms. And he has a list there of 9 different ways in which you could be deceptive. And some of them are more harmful. So for example, the sheker that really hurts people. There's sheker that really benefits the person telling it. There's sheker that benefits the person without hurting people. There's sheker that hurts people without benefiting. So a little different permutations. So there, Ben Yonah writes that the only category that you're allowed to do Mepnei HaShalom is when it doesn't have those elements at all. It doesn't hurt any other person. And it doesn't benefit you. So then you could be Mishan Mepnei HaShalom. So Gnevus Das, he specifically excludes from this category, that if there's something that benefits you by the misrepresentation, so that's not much of Bnei HaShalom, according to Ben Yonah. So there is some room to question that. It could still be true, there's still room to argue, but it's just worth noting that there is this point. Now, presumably the way those who allow this are coming from, what they're basically saying is that, yeah, you are getting false credit from this recipient, but it's still worth it. It's a trade-off. It's a values clash here, that either he's not going to get any help, or he'll get some help, and he won't be embarrassed, but he'll falsely be grateful to you without real basis, or without sufficient basis. So, seems like there's basically a trade-off there that's worth it, that he's the only victim, and he gains more than he loses. So the fact that he has a little bit of unwarranted gratitude to you is worth it in the long run because he himself benefits more from this whole scenario than what he is giving up in terms of a little extra gratitude to. So far, so good. But there are those who do have concern about this because of the issue of Gnevus Das, and that's somewhat of a discussion. But either way, what makes it okay, according to those who would allow it, is because it's all the same person. The one who is being deceived is really ultimately benefiting more than he is losing to the deception. So that's why there is at least what to talk about. So given everything that we've seen so far, right, and to emphasize that to misrepresent the popularity of a cause, let's say the Gemara in Sukkah, that involves at least two problems, both of which are problems, right, that the cause looks more popular than it is, and the donor looks more generous than he is, and both of those are problems that we don't allow, even for the purpose of Sukkah. And that the only deceptions that we've seen to be okay are emphasizing the urgency of the aniyim against the misimpression one could get that the kupa is all overflowing, and allowing somebody to collect on behalf of himself when really it's for others. There we also thought there was a scenario where there's minimal to no substantial misrepresentation. So all of this goes into the equation. So let me ask you the following scenario that I was asked once, practically speaking, in real life. And tell me what you think about it, based on now everything that we have learned. So I was asked by a charitable organization that has a journal or a dinner or whatever it is, some kind of a venue in which they publicize their donors. And they have, like many of these organizations do, they have many different levels. I will see the signs where there's all kinds of creative names that are used for the different categories. And let's say there are builders and friends and chavrusas and nice people and very nice people and whatever they call these categories. And there's the bronze circle and the silver circle and the gold circle and the platinum circle. So this organization, there was somebody who every year, let's say the past 10 years, he gave at the maximal level. He's on the platinum circle. And he's always giving at that level. And this year, he's had a rough year financially. He's not able to do what he can do. And it's not publicly known, but he's had a rough year. So he asked the organization that he's not going to be able to give as much as he has. He's giving at a level that would have been acknowledged at a much lower rung. But he's asking they should still keep him on the platinum level this year in their announcements. And hopefully in the future he'll be back where he was, but this year he's not there. And he wants to be announced at the platinum level, even though he's not actually giving. So based on everything we've talked about, what would you tell the organization? Can they do this? Can they go along with his request? Sorry? Well, you tell me. So you tell me, is it mutter, is it not? Yeah?
It's interesting because it would be allowing him to give while also maintaining his dignity.
Except he's not actually giving at that level, right? So he'll give something much less.
I think it's similar in terms of like it's saying something false in order to maintain someone's dignity. It's just a little different because it's the giver, not someone receiving. So.
Right, so it is different. So what do we do with that? Yeah,
I mean, just to raise a difference that I think. See, also, like in the other case, it's specifically to get other people to give that you're donating. This one, he's asking for his own, like, dignity and sake. Like, hey, can you do me this favor? It's not really deceiving other people to give more, necessarily.
Okay. I think that's an important point. Shmuel?
Yes, on the other hand, the whole point of announcing the names is to increase, I mean, one of the, I guess there's two points. One is to give these people cover so they donate, again, themselves donate again. But also, it's to get other people in the community to look at these people who are donating. Everyone should donate.
And therefore,
it's true he wants his name to be higher on the list, but like the whole structure of being on this list is to increase donations. So that factor, that might be like a net positive that would outweigh the.
But is that justifiable to increase donations that way? What about the Marsha and Melchus Yitzchak and the Yeshua and the Kinyan Torah? Does that help? Does that justify? Or maybe we've seen that it's not justified. Zach?
Well, there is the issue that it might be misrepresenting the cause, that people might think it's greater than it is because people are giving more, but they're not giving that much. Here it's almost the opposite, because people might say, oh, he's not giving as much anymore, he doesn't think the cause is as good anymore, because they don't realize that he's not, that
okay.
he wants money.
Okay, we'll take it. We'll take it. Yossi?
Yossi, what's the hata for lying or to avoid embarrassment?
Well, in general, it's considered to be a bnei hasham. And there's actually a more explicit Gemara in Bava Metzia that sounds like, without going into the ins and outs of it, sounds like that's true. Also, it's a good question because it's not obvious that embarrassment is included in Shalom, but there are Gemaras that do sound like that. Yeah, Max?
Just another sort of detail in that, perhaps to the point that he always gives, it won't even be noticed that he's still giving the same level.
Okay, so it's interesting that I think your comments are all well taken. And I think they're so well taken that they're closer to what I ended up telling them. Basically, the issue here is that there's potential Gnevas Das in two directions. Two cases of potential Gnevas Das here. That one, that the organization will look like it's getting more donations than it actually is, and we've seen from Gemara Shah and the Gemara and Sukkah and the like that is potentially deceptive. And there is the issue that the donor is going to look more generous than he actually is. And we've seen that that's potentially deceptive. So theoretically, there is a real question here because there's two degrees, two aspects of potential Gnevas Das. That being the case, I still told them that I thought it was okay. So why? For reasons which I think Zach and Max have both kind of got to a little bit, just to articulate a little drop differently, but I think your points were well taken, that what is the concern here? The concern is, okay, we're creating the impression that the tzedakah is the kind of tzedakah that gets these high-level donations. And we're creating the impression that the donor is the kind of donor who gives those high-level gifts. Yes, we're creating those impressions. But they're actually correct impressions because the organization does get those kind of donations and the donor does give those kind of donations. It's just this year, it's uncharacteristically impossible for him to do it. But for the past 10 years, he's been doing it. So if people respect him for his generosity, it's not misrepresentative, it's justified. He is that generous. He's been that generous all the time that it's been possible for him to do that. And if people think that the organization, they think it's a worthy organization because they get donations at that level, it's true. They do get donations at that level from people like this guy. It's just that this year he's unable to do it. So the degree, and I'm sympathetic to what Zach said, talked about the degree, you know, that much. So yes, there's a little bit of misrepresentation here in terms of the actual final dollar sum they're getting this year and the actual amount that this person is actually giving this year. But it's not enough to make a difference in anyone's perception because the respect that they'll have for this guy is still justified by all of his past donations. And the respect that they'll have for the organization is justified by everything they've received in the past. So there's not enough of a difference here that it's actually going to matter to anybody. So that is then weighed against the other factor that we're trying to protect this person's dignity, which we know is itself a value. And just to throw into it here, there is a discussion. We haven't talked so much about it here, but the Gemara's in Ksubis, which talk about tzedakah. So there, they have that very striking statement that's often quoted because it's so stunning and so surprising, that the obligation of de machsoro includes even great extravagances for somebody who used to be wealthy and had a very high, perhaps outlandishly high standard of living. So apparently de machsoro means we have to take that into consideration also. The Gemara gives outlandish examples that, say, somebody used to have a whole entourage of servants running in front of him, so if he now can't afford that anymore, you have to provide for servants to run in front of him as he goes in the street. So that's a big discussion, how that factors with other concerns, and why should that even be? There's a lot to say about that. But now, just to mention one interpretation of it, there are some who understand that this is not meant to be forever, It's just right now there is not a public awareness that this individual has had a downfall, and we want to save him from the embarrassment. So to protect him from having to be exposed too quickly in a too painful way as somebody who has had this financial downturn. So we're supposed to provide these external symbols of luxury in order to give him cover as if he's still able to afford this. So that's one interpretation of that din, but what it shows you is that it is a halachic value to try to help protect somebody from exposure that they're not ready for of having had a financial stumble. So you put all that together in the case of the organization, I think that it does justify that particular step. That here, the goal is one that the halacha validates, the idea that we're trying to protect somebody's public kavod as far as everyone knowing every detail of their financial ups and downs. We see that the halacha does apparently validate that goal. And it's coming at the cost of a little misrepresentation, but it's so minor because it does not create any actual different picture. The person has been generous in the past to this level, and this organization has gotten donations to that level from a person of that type. So there isn't any reputational significance in this misrepresentation. It's going to boil down to essentially the same thing. So still, we like to be completely honest all the time, but considering that there isn't anything here that actually is going to result in a significant misrepresentation, and the upside is this goal of protecting his kavod, which we know is a real thing, I think that comes together to allow it. And I think that's where a lot of you are headed also in your formulations. Does that, that make sense? Okay, so there's a lot to say about this. That is most of it. Tomorrow, I want to get into the topic of Shema Sakwa's Daka, but there's also one more fascinating consequence of all this, separate from the questions of what you can do with a chula or not. But there's a fascinating discussion to be had about after the fact, which opens up all kinds of other details of Staka, and it draws upon some of the makoros that I shared with you this morning. So tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, will also include that discussion. So we have also tomorrow to finish up that list from today, and that will segue us into the other. But as far as what you're allowed to do with Chachila, that's what we've been talking about these past few days, so we'll close that, but we'll talk about some of the consequences and the impact, Be'ez Hashem, tomorrow. Everyone should have a wonderful day.